This is the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, a podcast dude, and an all-around functional nerd. Today, I am once again talking to someone who is involved with Gen Con because the folks at the Gen Con Writer Symposium sent me a letter and said, hey, dude, would you mind helping us a little bit and kind of promoting stuff? I don't get anything for this. It's not like they said, we'd love for you to come to Gen Con. No! Maybe next year. But they did ask if I would talk to some people and promote the Writer Symposium a little bit and get some buzz going and get some people interested in it. So I said, sure. And I had this big, long list of people, and I went through and checked off some names. And this gentleman was kind enough to come back and say, sure, I'll do that. And his name is Stephen Blackmore. Stephen, why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Hello, I am Stephen Blackmore. I am an author writing noir and urban fantasy, particularly the Eric Carter Necromancer series, which is Dead Things and Broken Souls and the upcoming Hungry Ghosts. Ooh. And it is about a modern day necromancer who is forced to leave Los Angeles for 15 years and comes back to solve the murder of his sister. And things have changed quite a lot for him, and things go south from there. There are a lot of ghosts. There's a lot of dying and violence and swearing, and they're Aztec death gods. And that's that series, and that's what I write.
Very cool. And the Aztecs did kind of they had a huge body count.
They did. They had a very, very big body count. Mm-hmm. Pretty much everything that they every god they have is steeped in blood.
Yeah. Aren't there like pits where they're just full of skulls?
Yeah. Yeah. They're actually finding. I don't recall exactly what they're called, but there are these. They look kind of like drying racks that have. It's like two vertical pieces to hold it up, and then rods going across it and skulls impaled on them. And they've been finding them for a long time. They're finding more of them as they're digging around Mexico City. So they're finding more of these pits. It's kind of creepy.
You know, there was an ancient Aztec joke. If an Aztec invites you to church, you say no.
Okay.
Come on.
I don't know that one.
Because they're going to sacrifice you. Come on.
Of course.
That's what they did. They like went around and they got all the like people around them and just. It's terrible.
It was. Yeah. A lot of cutting.
Yeah.
A lot of cutting. Ugh.
So anyway, Stephen and I have chatted before. You were on Functional Nerds a while ago.
I was.
Long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
What's changed?
More books.
Uh-huh. Always good.
Yeah, there was Broken Souls, came out since then, I think, and I've done some tie-in stuff. I did a book called Con of Mars, which is a tie-in to the Evil Hat Productions Spirit of the Century pulp role-playing game, and I did a follow-up to Chuck Wendig's God and Monsters book, Unclean Spirits. Okay. Which is a series that Abaddon Books has been putting out, where the idea is that the gods have been kicked out of their respective heavens and they're stuck down here on Earth. And I wrote one called Mythbreaker that came out early this year, I think December.
Okay. You mean last year?
Last year. Late last year.
And, early this year means you're time traveling.
It certainly feels like it sometimes. And so there's just been a lot of that, a lot of working on books and being late on deadlines.
What is Evil Hat is so familiar. What do they do?
They do the Dresden Files.
Yes, that's why game. I know. Okay, yeah.
I knew several other things too.
Okay, because I just got into that game, and have been playing it a little bit.
Yeah, so. they do the Fate system.
Yes, I got into that too. That was kind of cool.
And in fact, I've been doing. They're doing a follow up to Spirit of the Century. Called Shadow of the Century that I've been writing setting pieces for, and it's an extension of Spirit of the Century pushed forward into the 1980s.
I'm always fascinated by people who write their own stuff but also kind of write tie-in stuff, right? That's a lot of rights in one sentence, but you'll forgive me. But it's completely different. So you're writing settings. What goes into that?
it's actually been an education for me for the gaming piece, because I'm coming at it right from writing a narrative. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing things like the different characters and different villains, companies, monsters, etc., that are in this world. And one of the things that I kept running into and got called on was that they felt I was making some of them too cool, because and that's how it was put to me, and I realized what they were getting at, because the whole idea is that you want a framework for the players to be the ones doing
yes.
the cool things.
I was just thinking that in my head when you were talking about it. It's like,
that's exactly it. Okay. And so there are actually a couple of things that we pulled that I'd written up, which I'm a little bummed about, because I really liked them.
Sure.
But I completely understand where they're coming from.
Right, because you want to give them enough to build on and do their
exactly.
and have the
exactly.
game and have fun, but not right. so much that you're kind of stifling their own creativity.
Exactly, because the whole thing is to have the players be the ones doing all the cool things, and it's been a bit of a mental shift for me. Mm-hmm. Once I figured that out, I was like, okay, now I understand that, and it made it, you know, and then it was much easier. But I'm used to writing narratives,
sure,
and I still am doing a little bit of that, but more in terms of color for the rest of the setting piece that I'm writing. So, giving the history of a particular villain, I'm going to want to, you know, make it interesting to read, but at the same time, I need to make sure that I'm getting across all the information so that the players can actually do something with it.
That's fascinating. To me, I don't know about the listeners, but it's different. It's not your normal storytelling, and there are so many writers out there like yourself who are doing this, right? They're not only creating their own stories and their own narrative. It's a full, complete story with character development and world building, and all these little, you know, things that you're putting in there. And to take that and then have to go and say, well, here's the box, and it's a pretty box. What do you want to put in it? Is it kind of what you're doing, right? You're giving the players and the game masters the ability to take that box and call it a transmogrifier if they want to.
Right, right. I had the same thing. I also did a story world for the game Storium, and this particular story world hasn't come out yet, but that's been a very similar kind of thing for me, because the whole thing with Storium as a game, it's very different from a role-playing game. It's really a narrative game. Each person is telling a chunk of the overall story, and they're mm-hmm. not necessarily focused on just their one character. And the way that the worlds are built, there are essentially seeds for these narratives to be created by the players. So that's a cast of characters, sometimes characters for the players to represent, as well as antagonists or, you know, other helpers and things like that, plus all the setting. And that one was interesting, because there was a much more mechanical aspect, because I'm creating the Storium world, you're really dealing with small chunks of descriptive text. And basically just giving little seeds to people to take things from where they want to go. So you're not even writing stories at that point.
Sure.
It's just here are your building blocks. Knock yourself out. So it's something that it's actually gotten me thinking about has been how different audiences are for particular types of writing.
Sure.
So, you know, for the stuff that I was doing for Shadow of the Century, that's not just for, you know, color, but also for the players, for the game master. And then something like Storium, it's for everybody, but at the same time, it's very reduced and very boiled down. And it kind of gets me thinking about, like, you look at a script, you know, that's not for the viewer, that's for the director, that's for, you know, the prop makers, cinematographer, etc. So you're talking to a different audience, and the gaming stuff kind of drove that home for me. And I'm sure, you know, I'm coming to game writing very late. I grew up as a gamer playing D&D and Traveler and, you know, all that in the 80s and 90s, and then kind of stopped. But getting back into it has been interesting and has actually kind of gotten me thinking about my other writing differently, and just how I'm paying attention to things and structuring things. So it's actually helped a lot.
I think you and I have had a similar path, because I did the same thing. I played a lot. And we talked before we started recording that I grew up in Fresno, and mm-hmm. and the listeners know this. They know I grew up in Fresno, and I played role playing games there, and I had a circle of friends there. And I had to move out of state. I had to go to Tennessee and kind of leave all my friends behind. And I think a lot of people have had the same experience. You go off to college, or you go off and do this or that. You move away from home. You don't see those friends anymore that you played these games with, and you get away from it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what happened to me. And it's been since, you know, the past few years that I've been involved with Pikes Peak Writers and different writers groups here in Colorado, that I found that people are still playing these games that I loved. And so I've started playing them again too. Magic the Gathering, mm-hmm. Dungeons and Dragons. I just recently got to play Pathfinder and the Dresden Files. And it's so much fun, and it really gets your creative juices flowing, right? A lot of the characters, a lot of my ability to build characters in my own writing came from when I started role-playing in World of Warcraft. It gave me a different level because, for example, I kind of refused in my writing to have a protagonist that was female, because I didn't think I could write a female character because I'm not female. Mm-hmm. I role-played one in World of Warcraft, and everybody's like, wow, this is a great character. And I thought, oh, it doesn't matter. All you have to do is create a great character. It doesn't matter what their gender is. And yeah. That kind of let me – that like broke the block in my own brain that was telling me I couldn't do it. Does that make sense?
Oh, no, it does. That's one of the things that I've had to –
And by the way, Stephen, just so you know, yeah. my critique group now, they're like, every time I write something, like, oh, great, Patrick's writing another female character.
I've found myself having some similar struggles. Mm-hmm. One of the things I tend to write a lot about Los Angeles, and one of the things about writing.
You mean the stealer of Fresno's water?
Yes, the stealer of Fresno's water.
Yeah,
and everybody else.
Los Angeles? Yeah.
Yeah, that Los Angeles, yeah.
still got those canals that just, you know, take all the rainwater and shoot it right out into the ocean.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They just, great just, city you planning
know,
there.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I was actually reading a thing on that today that they're trying to get a – I'm sure this is riveting for people listening, but where they're actually trying to – put in place some things to capture this stuff, because they lose something like 10 billion gallons during a storm.
Yeah.
It's nuts. Yes, this is why I'm sure your audience tuned in to hear about Los Angeles water reclamation projects.
They know me. They know that I jump on California because I grew up there, so it's okay.
I write a lot about Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I grew up here. I live here. I'm one of the few people who I know who can legitimately say I love Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I also hate Los Angeles, and I completely understand people hating Los Angeles.
Well, and if you're going to do noir, L.A. lends itself to noir.
Oh, it does. It
so
does.
Much.
Yeah. There's so much history to it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that particularly with the Eric Carter books – you can't talk about Los Angeles without addressing, to some extent, race. Mm-hmm. 50% of the population is Latino,
right,
in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. You have to acknowledge that. And I'm dealing with Aztec gods. And so there are cultural aspects that I don't really know very well. I know it as an outsider. Mm-hmm. So trying to trying to have characters that exist in that, when I'm outside looking in, I've really had to focus on, okay, well, what's going to make this a cool character? What's going to be interesting about this character? And do as much as I can and hope I don't screw it up. But I'm trying to focus less on specific things and more on the whole, okay, well, what's cool about this character kind of thing. Like what you were talking about with writing women characters and coming to it from a role-playing perspective. Kind of the same thing for me.
I get that. I do. And you talk about there are cities that just do lend themselves to storytelling. And LA is one of them. And yes, the population is 50% Latino. And
we've got everything here.
Yeah, and it's so spread out, because actually California, especially in Fresno, had a huge Southeast Asian population, and these were folks who were essentially refugees running. Like they wanted out of their country. And so in Fresno, we had a very large population of Vietnamese, like Lao Xun and Hmong. And so these were the kids that I was going to school with. And the part of me now, like the adult me, wishes that I had asked them more questions about their culture. Because I think that would be so cool to inform my writing today. You know, instead of having to do the damn research, damn it.
Yes.
To have, you know, because I already had those relationships going to school with these kids. And so it's just like adult me is like, stupid elementary school, Patrick. Why didn't you ask more questions? Anyway.
I get it. It's, yeah.
So Gen Con, you're going to Gen Con. We've talked a little bit about, and I do want to talk some more about your character here in a second, but I want to get the obligatory stuff out of the way here. So you're going to Gen Con. Do you know what you're going to be doing there?
Yes.
Okay. So you have like a schedule of stuff?
I have a schedule. I'm going to be on panels at the Writer Symposium.
Mm-hmm. Are you also doing like the regular con, or do they keep it separate?
From what I understand, it's like a con inside a con.
Right. And I think I was talking to Susan J. Morris, and I've talked to Elizabeth Baer. And from what I understand, the Writer Symposium has on its own like 9,753 different tracks.
Yeah. And it's crazy.
At any one time, you could be in 16,000 different panels. I could be exaggerating.
I don't think it's quite that high looking at the schedule, but it certainly feels like it.
Because they got like 3 or 4 or 5 tracks just in those symposiums.
Oh, yeah. Well, what's fascinating to me about this one, and it seems so different from a lot of other writer-centric conventions like Worldcon or pretty much anything. Like I was at Phoenix Comic Con, and they actually have a pretty good author track there. But what's interesting about all of this is that they're all either craft or business-related nuts and bolts kinds of panels.
It's like a writer's conference.
That's exactly what it is, and they've really. Let me see. I can pull up the schedule of some of the names. They've got a couple of craft tracks. They've got a business track. They've got a track that talks about just specific authors, and all of these things are things like how to make a living as a writer, part one.
Yeah.
Business of writing 101. Researching your story. Killing off characters. Novel outlines. You know, these are things that they, for whatever reason, don't talk about in a lot of the writers' conferences, particularly in genre that you see. And I think a lot of that has to do with more that those tend to be more fan centric, and this is definitely geared toward people who are looking to improve their writing or understand certain things about writing that go beyond, you know, a vague question of how do I find an agent, and drills down into how do I write a query letter,
right?
You know, it's things like that, and just seeing the the track from last year, because this is the first time I've gone, just really made me want to be involved in this, because it just looks like there is so much nuts and bolts kind of work here that people are clamoring for, but they're just not really getting.
And here's the thing. So there are definitely writers' conferences that talk about that stuff. Pikes Peak's writers one.
Oh yeah.
You know, Angie Hodapp works for Nelson Literary. She was talking about contract stuff that I had never heard before. Mm-hmm. It was blowing my mind. You had like Josh Vogt there talking about how he makes a living as a writer. You know, he is 100% supported by being a writer. So there are conferences out there that do that, but yeah, it's typically not at the big cons like you're talking about, like a world con. But the thing about Gen Con is, yes, there are these great things like you're talking about that writers are going to be so interested in and so focused on, and it's going to help them. But at the same time, if you're a fan, guess what? All these writers are going to be there doing this stuff. And then you can also walk up to them and get them to sign books or talk to them about their stuff. Mm-hmm. And the secret sauce that I've always talked about, there is a secret sauce. There's a code word that you can use with any writer to get them to talk to you. And that's, can I buy you a drink?
Your drink. Yep.
You'd be surprised how well that works. Before you know it, Lou Andrews is sitting in your lap. It just happens.
Those wacky writers.
So what are you doing there? I mean, you're talking about all these other things that are going on. What specifically are you involved with?
I'm going to be on a panel. Here's the thing is I have titles of the panels. Mm-hmm. No other information, but some of them, I mean, they're pretty obvious. Common People in Epic Conflicts, mm-hmm. Rewrites and Second Drafts, mm-hmm. Description Through Dialogue. Unlikable characters. I'm good with unlikable characters. Mm-hmm. And one called Monsters and Other Horrors. I'm not sure what that one is about, actually. But the Congress. One that I'm... Yeah, exactly. the one I'm really looking forward to, actually, is Thursday night. And we're going to be doing a live Storium game, which is going to be fascinating. It's going to be a charity. It's like $4 for admission, and all the money goes to charity. And it's Chuck Wendig is going to be running the game. It's going to be me, Sam Sykes, Delilah Dawson, and damn it, who else?
Okay, so I'm sorry, but I have to throw the flag down on this play. No. You can't have Sam Sykes, Delilah Dawson, and Chuck Wendig together in a room.
Oh, it's
chaos. It's going to be chaos.
Oh, it will be. That's the whole point of having it.
In fact,
that might just be the four of us. I think it might be just the four of us. But it's going to be nuts. We're going to be working on a Storium story, and our screens will all have laptops, and our screens will be projected. That's what I'm told. I don't know exactly how this is going to work, but it will be epic.
So
it'll be epic and frightening.
So two things. One, Gen Con is July 30th through August 2nd, and you're saying that first Thursday is when the Storium game is going to happen. We've mentioned Storium a couple of times now. I want to assume that all of our listeners are aware of Storium and what it is, but just in case they're not, do you want to explain what Storium is?
Yeah. This is it's an online, I'm sure I'm going to flub this, story.
Online multiplayer game.
Online multiplayer story creation game.
Yes.
So what you have is a narrator, and you have players who, and they each have their own character, but they're not necessarily playing just their character. The idea is that the narrator starts a scene and sets up challenges and the players have either abilities or their characters have abilities or objects that can meet those challenges. And what they have to do is actually write a part of the scene describing what's being done. And because you're dealing with it from a scene perspective rather than my character goes and does this thing, there's a certain amount of control over what the other players' characters are doing as well, because mm-hmm. you're talking about this chunk of the scene. and it goes around and everybody puts in their particular piece. And the idea is that your point of view character, really, and I'm sure people are playing this differently in some ways as well because it's so open, but your point of view character is really what you're writing about. And at the end of this round, there is a scoring mechanism based on the challenge that the narrator puts out and the way that the players respond to it, which determines, does the narrator get control of the end of the scene or do the players? And is it a positive outcome or a negative outcome? And then that, and then whoever basically has the ball at that point finishes up the scene, and then it goes on to another one. And the idea is that you maintain this improvisational story for however long the story is supposed to last. And usually the narrator has a good idea of what's supposed to happen because the narrator is guiding it along, but it's all this long collaborative way of telling stories, like sitting around a campfire and telling, you know, ghost stories to each other. You know, everybody's involved. I don't know if you're familiar with the game Fiasco.
No.
It's kind of similar to that, just in terms of everybody has a piece of the narrative to grow on and for people to respond to. So there's a big improv element to the whole thing. And I'm sure the Stephen Hood who runs the company and created Storium, I'm sure he's going to hear this and go, no. You know, and go, oh my God, you're totally missing the point.
No, you did a good job. You did a good job. But I can guarantee you that, you know, Chuck Wendig is going to, set a scene, and then Sam Sykes is going to have his characters fight somebody. And then, you know, Delilah, who knows what Delilah's going to do. Yeah.
Delilah will probably murder someone.
No, you'll bring him back to life.
Oh, no, I'll just murder more.
So you're doing that on Thursday, and you're really excited about it.
Doing that on Thursday night.
That's awesome. Because it is. There's a lot of role-playing stuff going on. There's a lot of gaming stuff going on.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and obviously. But that's one of the things that really fascinates me about the Writer Symposium is that they're able to slot it in the middle of Gen Con and have a pretty good expectation that it's going to be full.
Yeah.
I mean, that blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's going to be crazy.
Yep.
So anything else going on at Gen Con that you're super excited about?
I don't really know what's happening outside the Writer Symposium. A lot of the I fully expect I'm going to be going into some of these panels as audience too. I mean, there's some stuff on pitching projects. I suck at pitching. Absolutely suck at pitching. You know, I've got my way of doing outlines, but I'm fascinated to see how other people do outlines and synopses.
Yeah.
I
tried pitching once, but the coach's son got the job, so.
The different things that are in this, I'm looking forward to a lot of the panels that are going on. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
If you're really interested in other ways of doing outlining, look at 2K to 10K.
I've seen it.
Rachel Bach / Rachel Aaron. And that's the first outlining book that really clicked with me. And I even went out and built my own Scrivener template to work hand in hand with the techniques that she employs. So it really, really spoke to me. So I'm just throwing that out there.
I've heard of it. I will check it out.
It's definitely cool. Gail Carriger also recommended it to a lot of people, so it's worth your time. So why a necromancer?
Why a necromancer? Originally, this is a little bit of inside baseball, I think, on the series. There's a book set in the same world that actually, it's a standalone, but it takes place about 6 months before the book Dead Things. And it's a different character, also set in Los Angeles, different circumstances. The character's a thug named Joe Sunday, who is killed and brought back to life.
Did you say Solomon Grundy?
No, Joe Sunday is his name. It's very pulpy. It's very violent. But the intent for the series was that it was going to be based in this world where magic exists, and there are mages, there are monsters and demons and so on. My own particular take on some of them, but those things are there. And so I wrote that one, and then I had this idea of nobody really talks about necromancers. It's not there. There are a few books, featuring that mm-hmm. kind of character.
Yeah, there was one in the Dresden Files at one point.
Yeah. But it also struck me as something that I thought was particularly noirish. And so I did Dead Things, and when I turned that in to my publisher, they said, "Would you be interested in changing your idea around and doing the series just with this character?" And I'm sure I can do that. and it's worked, actually. It's worked out for me. I actually found that I like this character more than pretty much any other character I've ever written. And one of the things that it's allowed me to do is talk about certain things about LA that don't really get discussed in urban fantasy. Mm-hmm. He's one of his abilities is that he sees ghosts everywhere.
Yeah.
And they're very hidden to everyone else. To him they're all over the place, but nobody else can see them. And one of the things I didn't realize I was doing this until I was pretty much at the end, realized that I was looking at them the way that I think of the homeless in LA. Nobody sees them. They're very much hidden. They're very much shunned. They kind of get pushed away into the corners. Mm. And that kind of acted as a springboard for me to look at other things with LA and with cities in general, because there's particularly with urban fantasy, there's a big emphasis on the fantasy part, but not usually much on the urban part. Okay. And there are just some things that I like. For example, we have a big problem. Depending on who you ask, if it's a problem, we have a lot of gentrification going on in certain parts of Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and it's pushing out a lot of people. And it's already an expensive city. I mean, similar things are happening in San Francisco. New York is having that in certain areas. I mean, it's just getting more expensive and pushing more people out.
Sure.
And it got me thinking of, well, what would gentrification do in an urban fantasy environment? What's that really going to do to people who may already be on the fringes of things? How is that going to affect them? And it gives me an opportunity to kind of play around with that. Not to be preachy mm-hmm. about it,
sure.
But just to use that as an aspect of the story.
Well, and that's the best. That's the best science fiction and fantasy.
It's
when you, because in science fiction and fantasy, that's where you can talk about stuff, and people don't necessarily know that you're talking about it, but you're still getting through to them.
Yes, and that's my hope. Because, like I said, I don't want to be preachy at all. Because sure. there are so many sides to all of these situations that it's, and I have my particular view, but at the same time, not all of my characters necessarily would, and so it gives me an opportunity to at least explore it. And I write about LA a lot. Probably too much. I talk about it probably way too much.
It's funny. Did you grow up in LA?
Yeah.
Okay. So you grew up in LA. Growing up in Fresno, I don't write about Fresno. I just don't. And I don't know. I've never thought about it before until you just said something. But like, I don't really, I think I wrote one story that was a little bit about Fresno, but that was years ago.
For me, one of the things that has me wanting to write about LA is that there's a mythology to it.
Okay.
That pretty much everybody has an idea of. If you say LA to someone, they're going to have certain things in mind. Hollywood's going to pop up. Everybody's fake, and oh my God, it's the sun's always shining, and you know, all these different things. Mm-hmm. And there's the mythology layer, and then there's what things really are. We have a lot of entertainment industry in Los Angeles, but it's very concentrated into a few small pieces. There are a lot of other things about LA that nobody even thinks about or talks about. And being able to poke around on those and kind of subvert people's expectations of what this place could be or really is in some instances. And I don't think you get the same kind of the same kind of opportunities with a place like Fresno or, you know, Bakersfield or, you know, San Francisco, you can do that with Las Vegas, New York, Chicago, places that everybody has a certain connection to for no other reason than they've heard of it.
Right. Yeah. It brings to mind something. You know, when you say LA to me, It brings to mind my first trip. I had to go to San Diego for some training for a job. I had to drive from Fresno to San Diego, and I just happened to time it perfectly so that I hit LA at 5:15 p.m.
Yeah, so it's traffic is how you see LA.
I see LA as that 4.5 hour trip to San Diego.
Right.
Yeah.
That sea of cars, nobody's moving, everybody's pissed off, everybody's too hot.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
or Anaheim, where you know I got a hotel room that was very close to the Anaheim Convention Center. It was only two blocks away. Little did I realize that right there by Disneyland, one block is equal to about 12 blocks in any other city in the world.
Yes, yes. It's like, oh yeah, I'll just walk over to
This is gonna be so cool. No, I'm two blocks from the convention center. Suck. Yeah, I had blisters. So I get what you're saying is what I'm getting at. Yeah.
And so you can do that with certain cities.
Sure.
And every city, particularly every large city, but every city has its own legends, its own local myths that have grown. And with LA, I don't think it's necessarily got more. But it has more that I think tugs at people's consciousness, because everybody thinks they know what this place is like because they've all seen it on their TV or in a movie. That's like, well, that's what LA is like, and so you know, there's you look at here's one. This is from the 30s. There was this guy who got written up in the LA Times. He shows up. He says he's a geologist and claims that there are tunnels underneath downtown Los Angeles filled with lizard men who have these gold tablets. And he got a permit to start digging in a particular spot. And the LA Times ran a story on him on the front page, you know, and they started to actually take him seriously.
Well, and the lizard people can't have that. I mean,
you don't screw with the reptoids, man.
They're currently in charge of the world. I mean, they run everything, so they can't let something like that go by. There's just no
right.
way.
So of course, obviously, you know, they're that he got laughed out eventually. But wait a minute, he's got a bunch of things like that.
Did the story say anything about a blue police box nearby?
No, no blue police boxes.
Oh, okay. So we don't have to worry about that. So it wasn't those lizard people.
Not those lizard people.
Okay.
But digging into that story,
digging into it, really? Is that your pun?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. You find that it looks like he may have heard of a different story of buried Spanish gold from when it was the area was ranchos,
right?
Before California became part of the Union. So there's all these little details, and take it in context of what we have now. I find it fascinating because there are all these little connections to very weird shit.
Well, and I do know, I mean, for a fact that there are some hidden places there, because Don Diego mm-hmm. de la Vega had his mm-hmm. had his rancho there, Ranchero, and of course he had the cave where he kept all his Zorro stuff.
Yeah, damn straight. Because how else is he going to go swash all those buckles?
Heck yeah. So sadly, Steven, I'm running out of time.
Okay.
I had promised you a certain amount of time, and we're coming up on that. So let's tell some people some stuff about you. What, do you have a website?
I have a website. It is Steven Blackmore, StephenBlackmore.com. Not to be confused with a Stephen Blackmore with one O, who happens to be the royal botanist in Edinburgh. So I get confused with him a lot. But that's my website, and I can be found on Twitter at S Blackmore. I scream into the void quite a lot there. And my books, Dead Things, Broken Souls, Hungry Ghosts, will be coming out probably late next year. And also the book Mythbreaker through Abaddon Books. I enjoyed writing that one, and I think people should read it.
Very cool. And you'll be at Gen Con July 30th through August 2nd. Any other conventions, book signings, anything that place you're going to be or any of that kind of good stuff?
Not this year. Gen Con and Phoenix Comic Con were my big ones. So
okay. If someone has a book, and do you have like a thing on your website where they can get a signed copy or something like that?
Yes. Awesome. Yes. Come to my website. Email me. Mm-hmm. My email's on there. Shout at me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter all the goddamn time. It's a wonder I get anything done.
And for the benefit of the listeners, Steven did tell me that he's a hugger. So if you see him,
I am a hugger.
If you see him at Gen Con, give him a big hug.
I am a hugger.
Thank you,
and
Steven.
A snuggler.
Anything else you want to tell the listeners before I let you go?
Come to Gen Con. Come to the Storium thing. It will be awesome.
Very cool. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF&F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
It's like talking to a child.
Magic wooey.
Wah, wah. Thinking and crap.
I don't even know what the horseman is.
And scene, you bastard.